Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. For my good wishes.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true.
And tonight we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day right now, right here on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network. Our first guest, Zoe Fitzgerald Carter, she's been writing an uplifting memoir about a tough subject. Her book is Imperfect Endings, A Daughter's Story of Love, Loss, and Letting Go. And it's about her mother's decision to end her own life with her long battle with Parkinson's disease. The book has been featured on O Magazine. People Magazine says Imperfect Endings, People Magazine says it, coaxes beauty from the bleak. And let's welcome Zoe. Zoe, hi, welcome to the show.
Much. Glad to be here.
Oh, Zoe, thank you so much for being here. You know, that's an issue that so many people face today, and is going through it. It's tough. But if there's not a process of letting go and completing with whatever it was with that loved one you've lost, it can stay with you for the rest of your life.
I think that's true. I think goodbyes are important, although I do want to say that I think what's most important is the life you've led with somebody. And sometimes, unfortunately, some of us can't get to the bedside, or we don't end up saying the things we wish we had said to people. And I think to comfort oneself, it's important to remember that it was all the ways that you were there for the person while they were alive.
You know, I found over the years, you know, my mom passed away in 1992, and I still talk to her. I hear she can, I'm walking down the hall, I still hear her voice saying, how can one person leave such a mess? But, you know, she fell asleep. But the point is, if there was anything to let go of, it was let go. She didn't have to necessarily be here, but I really believe those things that you hold on to are within yourself as opposed to that other person.
Well, I do think that's true. I think in my case, the letting go was letting go of my ideas about how my mother should die and letting her make the choices that she was so committed to making. When she first started talking about wanting to end her own life, I was very against it. You know, I loved my mother. I didn't want her to go any sooner than she had to go.
Sure.
And so I think the letting go for me in the title of the book is really about letting go of my own ideas about what I wanted and really trusting her to make the decision that was right for her, as difficult as it was for me.
You know, what an interesting point. We have a very hard time separating between us from them. What you would want to do, you in the general sense of the word, what you or I would want to do is completely different from this person who's going through all of this pain, all the challenges, that really the value for not being here is senior to the value for being here and going through all of it. And I really believe, as hard as it is, you just said it all. It's their decision in their life, and what we want has nothing to do with how they feel and what their experience at the time.
Absolutely. I think it can be a selfish decision to want to have someone stay longer than they want to. I think sometimes, unfortunately, people at the end of their lives are in pain or they're exhausted. My mother had Parkinson's for many years and some other medical conditions, and not only was she very exhausted by the need to constantly medicate herself and all of the losses of her physical capabilities, she was very afraid of what lay ahead for her. And I think there are those people, and I think they're the exception to the rule, who really want to have things under their control at the end. And as much as we might like to have them let nature take its course and just help them with drugs and whatever it is to make them comfortable, there are those individuals who really feel that they want to die on their own terms. And
sure.
And as I said before, I think we have to let them make that choice.
Interesting point, because let's say, you know, with your sisters, you get together, you decide, well, this is the best thing for her in her mind, so let's go along with this and let's give her her last wish. If we've done anything in our life for her, and it doesn't matter how we feel, we're doing it for her. It's at that point, it's 3,000% unselfish. But you run into something else, the legal ramification of an assisted suicide.
Yes.
There's an interesting point and something that you have to skate on thin ice with.
Well, that's absolutely true. And I just want to say about your point about siblings, because I know in my case, and it's something I write about in the book, that all of I have two older sisters, and we were not all on the same page with my mother, although, you know, in the fundamental ways I think we were. But I do think siblings and how we get along with our families when we have a parent who's aging or needing more help or facing the end of their life is very important and a big part of the experience for people. But, you know, in terms of the legal aspects of assisted suicide, they're very complicated and controversial in this country, and we only have three states where physician-assisted suicide is legal, and I think you know, there's a lot of fear and from my point of view, a lot of misunderstanding about it. It is not actually doctors ending someone's life, and that they don't come and give an injection and end someone's life. They just provide the means for the person. The person ends their own life. It just happens under their care, which actually it would have been great if my mother had had that option. She was not. She did not live in a place where it was legal. And yes, my sisters and I did worry tremendously about it. And if you read the book, you can see the ways that we solved that problem. And I'm not trying to be coy about it, but just for the sake of time. Yes, it is a very big concern. You're absolutely right.
Now, how do you move through that? You help with an assisted suicide. It's in a state where it's not legal. Could you not, in the end result, worst case scenario, could you not end up in jail?
You absolutely could end up in jail. And people, it does happen to people. There was a woman out in California whose mother begged her to help her end her life. And actually, I think her mother actually ended her life on her own volition, but the daughter wasn't quite sure if she was dead, and she did put a pillow over her face, and she made the mistake of telling her brother that, and that woman did end up in jail. It really does happen. It's unusual. I think there are lots of ways that it doesn't necessarily come to light. And I also want to say that, you know, in every minute of every day in hospitals across this country, there is so-called hastened death happening, where a doctor, just through compassion, is giving a little bit more morphine than maybe the person needs.
Sure.
And maybe they die in 3 hours as opposed to 3 days or 6 hours. And I think that happens, and that's it's a compassionate choice that a doctor makes. It's a gray area, and it is, again, tricky legally. Those doctors obviously have to worry about somebody, if a family member thinks they somehow did something wrong. They can bring a lawsuit, and absolutely people do go to jail for this.
Now, one of the things I know you talk about in the book, Oregon passed the nation's first death with dignity law in 1994. Now,
yes,
that's going to be an HBO documentary, but I think the key here is this. Will it spread? Will other states see the validity in this and the compassion in this? And I have to use the both words together here.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I do think that we're moving in that direction. It's interesting that Vermont has just proposed to put a very similar law on the books that Oregon and Washington State have. But on the other hand, what's also interesting, Michael, is that Idaho has just made it a felony for physician-assisted suicide. So they're going in the other direction and trying to prevent it and make it a more legally challenging situation. So I think as a country we are really debating this issue, and I think there's a lot of emotion and feeling on both sides of the fence. And I don't think there's one right answer. I mean, I think we as a culture have to kind of duke it out and hopefully move forward. I mean, I do think there's a right answer. There's my answer. But I think that, you know,
sure,
we're going to need to debate it for many years to come. I do think we're probably moving in the direction of more states passing laws like Oregon's. That's my guess.
Zoe, it has to do with culture also. You know, you come from a certain time zone. It doesn't matter geographically where you're from, but there's a certain time, you know, there are people who are 40, 50 years old, people who are, 20, 30 years old, 60, 70, and those different age brackets, we look at things very differently, and I think it's becoming more and more acceptable as the culture begins to change now.
I do think that's true. I think that's a really interesting point. I think especially as, you know, I think some of these other issues change in our culture, people's thoughts about abortion and all kinds of controversial issues. I think, you know, we're a changing society, and it's true that the younger generations start to define gay marriage is another case in point. I think over time things that are really not accepted become more and more accepted, and people start to understand them in a different way. And I think they understand that it's not somebody else making the choice for them. It's that everybody is given a choice. It's about freedom of choice. It's not about, I would never tell anybody else that assisted suicide was right for them. It's an absolute personal choice, as I would say about abortion as well.
And to bring it to the table, to discuss it, I think that's really got to be tough. You know, you're raised by someone, you know, your mom, your dad, and they've got a debilitating disease. They don't want to be around anymore. And you've got to sit there at the table and discuss it. There's got to be a way to do this, and there should be centers. There should be courses to take. I'm serious about this. Or if it becomes legal.
I think it is it's a really nobody wishes that to have to deal with something like that. It is very it's a very difficult topic, definitely.
Yeah, and the reason I say, of course, like this, when you were, and I won't ask you how old you are, but when you were 10, 12 years old, you had a definition of money. When you were 18 to 20, you had another definition, and as you grow, you have a completely different definition. You look at it differently. And I think that's really where the key is commonality of definition. But someone had to teach you about money. You fell down, you got up again, you did whatever you did. But there should be courses on economy. There should be courses on relationships. And there should also be courses on death and dying. It is something that we deal with.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. It's a fabulous idea. You know, one thing I wanted to say before is, you know, I think... the thing that's very hard for people to understand is that it can be the compassionate thing to respond to a parent's desire to end their lives by supporting them. I think we always think that's such a terrible thing. Like, how could you ever support your parent in wanting to die? I mean, it sort of feels like it's one step away from killing them or something, which is, you know, so horrifying to us. But I think until you have walked in those shoes, or you can, in a course like you're talking about, imaginarily, you know, walk in those shoes, I think it's hard to understand how it can actually be the compassion and the moral thing to do to help a parent who is in agony, who is distraught, whose quality of life is gone, who is begging you to help them to end their life. And I think until you are there, or until you can imagine yourself being there, it's a hard place to go. People don't want to think about it. It's a difficult thing to think about. And I think in this culture too, as you have implied, we're very death phobic. I think we don't want to talk about death. We don't want to consider our own death, and we don't want to go there emotionally.
You know, there was a thought I had as you were talking. I was visualizing sitting down with somebody, having that particular discussion, and the guilt, quote unquote, that someone would get in their ability or inability to help somebody pass on. But the thought about it is, it's not up to you. It's not your feelings. It has nothing to do with you. It has to do with that person. And if you could separate yourself from that person and realize that this is what they want, and what a tremendous end-of-life gift to give to someone.
Yes, I absolutely agree with you, and I would like to step outside of my own
sure.
my own point of view in a way to say, because I do believe that physician-assisted suicide should be legal in this country, and I feel very passionately about that. But I also feel, and it's one of the things that I write about in the book, is that it's not easy for the families of somebody who's making that choice, and I really wanted to speak to that experience. It's not all about the person. I mean, you're right that it is all about the person who's making the choice, but I mean, the fact is that we live in families, we're social animals, and it affects everybody, family and friends, around the person who's making that choice. And I know in my mother's case, you know, her friends, 95% of them completely supported her. Her daughters did support her in the end, although I have to say I gave her, you know, a lot of resistance for a long time.
Sure.
But it has an impact on the family, and I think we have to be cognizant of that as well.
Look what you have to put up with, again, in the general sense of the word. Let's say it happened with me, and I decided I'm going to help my mom do this. And all of the people, and let's say it's a known fact, it's nothing hidden. And all of the people that I know, all of the judgments that I have to face mm-hmm. on a daily basis, that could wreck a life for the rest of a life. So there's all those things to take into consideration. It's not only from you looking at them, but also them looking at you, and what's the consequence for you taking that step to help them. So all of those things have to be put into the mix and then sorted out, brought to the table, and looked at.
Yeah, it's a very personal equation that you have to come up with. And I think that one thing that does help and is important is that your parent make their wishes known to many people, as my mother did. You know, she told many friends what she wanted. She told her doctors what she wanted, although they could not legally help her with it. She had signs all over her house saying, do not call 911, because she was worried that something would happen to her and she would end up in a hospital and not be able to get out. So, you know, she was very clear about it. She had advanced directive. That's another thing I really recommend. And I really recommend having conversations with your parents before you're in a crisis situation and really understanding what it is that they want at the end and whatever that is. I mean, maybe they want every last measure, heroic and otherwise, to happen to them in the hospital and everything that can be done to save them. Or maybe they really want to at some point say, that's enough, I want to come home, and it's really important to them that they die at home, that they die when they're still coherent. And, you know, the more we have these conversations, the more we plan ahead, I think the better we are, the better chance of having the kind of death that our parents want or we want for ourselves when the time comes.
Well, Zoe, the unknown now becomes the known. If it's all of a sudden you get presented with this, that's scary stuff. Who knows what kind of a response you're going to have. But if you're talking about it beforehand, if you have an idea, a plan beforehand, then it's still rough to do, but at the same time, it's not an unknown. Zoe, we're running out of time. Website we can find you at?
You can find me at imperfectendings.com, and I love to hear from readers, and I'm happy to talk to book groups, and my book, you can buy my book through my website. It's imperfectendings.com, or certainly on Amazon or any of the major book carriers.
Wonderful. Hey, Zoe Fitzgerald Carter, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your topic, and more people should hear about it.
Thank you, Michael. I really enjoyed talking to you. Take care.
Okay, good night.
All right. Bye-bye.
Now that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Stay up, stay tuned, stay with us, and whatever you do, tell your friends about it.
There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking, in return, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser. By the way, if there's a topic you want discussed, if there's someone you'd like to hear interviewed, get a hold of us. You can go to www.dresserafterdark.com. Get a hold of Radio Susie. She's right there on the homepage, and she'll find who you want, and we'll get them on the air. Our next guest coming up, who should be here momentarily, Michael Murray. Oh, you're there. Hi, Michael Murray. How are you?
Hi, Michael. I'm good. Thank you.
Good. You're the founder of The Note Project, How a Simple Note of Appreciation Can Change a Person's Life and How It Can Change Your Life Also. Mike, what a wonderful, phenomenal idea. Just that little bit of a something can do a life change. Where was it that you got that light bulb that came on that said, this could change the world?
Well, I tell you, actually the inspiration came from my sister. It all started with a note that my youngest sister sent to me several years ago. You know, when we were little, our parents divorced and my brothers and sisters were put in an orphanage. I moved away, lived with my dad, but I visited my siblings whenever I could and always tried to do something special on those visits. But, you know, I never knew what they thought of me in my visits. And then years later, I received a note from my youngest sister thanking me for some of the memories she had of those visits. And I tell you, that note healed years of self-doubt for me. And, you know, I found myself rereading it many times. And then I realized, you know, I should share my sister's note and this message about the importance of sharing appreciation. So first I did it and I just wrote a newspaper article and did it that way. And then later I thought, well, what more can I do? And I ended up writing a book about it. And now I'm trying to share that message through the Note Project.
You know, really, when you really come down to it, how powerful it is, just a very small note, and it's what you've said, it's the power of appreciation. You've written essays, fiction, drama, sketch comedies, published stories, essays in the Sunday Magazine, Chicago Tribune, Denver Post, Baltimore Sun, and I mean, the list goes on. Mike, really, when it really comes down to it, there's nothing as strong as a very simple thank you, is there?
That's absolutely right, Michael. Thank you for mentioning all the things I've written. I tell you, I've always done creative writing, pretty much for my own satisfaction and fulfillment. It's hard to make a living doing creative writing. So what I've always done to make a living is I've done speech writing for executives over the years. So I've helped CEOs of Fortune 500 companies write speeches and annual reports and all those types of things. And I tell you, one of the things I've learned is that Even the CEO of a Fortune 500 company is a little bit intimidated when it comes to putting words on paper. And so that's been my job over the years, is to kind of help them, find the words. And so I thought, well, if I can help CEOs, maybe I can help some other people, because you're exactly right. One little note, and that note from my sister was only a paragraph long. But a note like that can contain quite a powerful punch.
You know what, one of the things, Mike, that we miss, and I think that's what causes a lot of the trouble with kids today, especially when it's the bonding of a family, and this has a lot to do with appreciation, because it's identity, and it's very important to your identity. If you don't get it at home, you go out and find it someplace else, and a lot of kids get in trouble with gangs and so on and so forth. But the moment that you get a note of appreciation, there's that other word called acceptance. So when you can be when you have identity and you also have acceptance, those two ingredients cause somebody to fill up very rapidly.
It does. I tell you what, you think about it. Put yourself in someone else's shoes. Think about, what would make you feel good about your time here on this planet, and the need to be appreciated is one of the most powerful urges that we have within us. And if you can help to fill that for somebody, if you can help to make someone else feel appreciated, you are doing a very powerful thing. You're right. It helps them with their own identity. It helps with their self-worth. But I'll tell you the really amazing thing that I've discovered. I've been doing workshops about, real simple. I go out to community centers and local libraries and just do free workshops on, the importance of appreciation and how to write a note of appreciation, and just walk people through it step by step. And the thing that I've learned as I've done this is that, obviously, if you send a note of appreciation to somebody, you're going to make them feel good, right? Everybody wants to be appreciated.
Absolutely.
It's important.
Sure.
But the little bit of a surprising thing is that it's going to make you feel good, too. And I don't think people realize that until they actually sit down and write a note of appreciation, tell somebody how they feel, and put that in the mail. It makes them feel good. They feel good about themselves. They've done good for somebody else by making them feel appreciated. But they've also done good for themselves because they're letting out those feelings. We can't walk around with those pent-up feelings, good or bad. So
sure.
If you've got some good feelings about somebody, boy, let them know it. It's going to make you feel good too.
There's an interesting thing that occurred about 2-3 years ago. Radio Susie and I went downtown Milwaukee. We had a business appointment. So we met and we teamed up and we went down and we got in front of the building. And there was a young woman, probably 32, 33 years old, and she's standing on the other side of the door. And as I walked in, I opened the door, Susie walked in, and I stood there and I held the door open so this woman could walk out. And she walked out, yeah. Stood in front of me. She almost had tears in her eyes. And she said, people don't do that anymore. They don't pay attention or appreciate. And she said, thank you for holding the door open. And it probably made her day, but the point of contention was it also probably changed her mind that, quote unquote, people can be respected in very small ways, but it's something that says you're alive, you're a human being, I know you're there. And that's why I think with the appreciation, with the note of appreciation, you can't get a better gift than that.
Well, you know what I like about that little story you just told, Michael? So, you know, holding the door open for somebody, that's a nice thing to do. That's an act of kindness, right, to help somebody that way. But, you know, probably what's even more rare is to do what that woman did, which was to stop and take a moment to thank you for doing that. You know, that made you feel good too, right?
You bet it did. But Mike, she had tears in her eyes. You know, and you know what? I felt acknowledged for acknowledging her.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I'm going to read you something if you don't mind.
Please.
This is a quote from Dr. Wayne Dyer, who talks about acts of kindness. And, you know, I consider sending a note of appreciation to be an act of kindness. And so this kind of gets to that point of how it affects people, more people than you realize. So he says that research has shown that a simple act of kindness directed toward another human being improves the functioning of the immune system and stimulates the production of serotonin in both the recipient of the kindness and the person extending the kindness. So even more amazing is that persons observing the act of kindness have similar beneficial results. So kindness extended, received, or observed beneficially impacts the physical health and feelings of everyone involved. So that kind of blows my mind when you realize just how much of a ripple effect it can have on people around you.
Oh, no question. You know that old adage that laughter is the best medicine?
Yeah.
What actually happens when you laugh, same thing that Dyer said. What happens when you laugh, your brain releases endorphins, which obviously makes you feel good. And when you hear something that will make you feel good, your brain releases the chemicals. Then you feel good. As a matter of fact, your brain and your body take care of you based on what you're presented with. And he was right on. He was so spot on, it's unbelievable. And the moment you give somebody a note, you create a complete chemical reaction within their body. Their brain goes into action. The endorphins are released. They get a dopamine rush, and they're ready to roll.
Yep. Yeah. Exactly right.
Love every second of it.
That's
a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah, well, thanks. Thanks. Yeah, I'm excited about it. I'm realizing the more people hear about this, it's just such a simple idea. And the more people hear about it, they're like, yeah, this is a great idea. I'm going to do it. You know, so I'm excited. People have started sharing some of their notes on I've got the website, noteproject.com, and there's a space on there where people can share their notes. And people have started doing that. And if you go there and read them, they're really moving. And, and sometimes I also realize that, sometimes a note is a very personal thing. People may not want to share the note, so sometimes people will share the story behind the note. You know, they'll tell about what the person did that they're thanking them for. So you can also read those kinds of stories. And I tell you, it's really very moving, very powerful stuff.
You know, by the way, that simple note, and on the website, you could possibly save a life with that. And as easy as it is, as simple as the process is, the emotional impact, you can't even put a value on it.
I think that's very true. You just can't underestimate. You know, I forget who said it, but I wish I could remember. There's a quote that I've used many times, and basically the person says that I think it's William James, actually. He said that one of the most basic needs of any human being is the need to be appreciated. And, boy, you're absolutely right. That can save a life.
You bet it can. Go ahead.
I was going to say the other thing is that you know, these notes like this, these are the kinds of things that become prized possessions. These are the kinds of things that people save. You know, when I do these workshops, I ask people, how many of you have a handwritten note among your prized possessions? And almost every hand in the room goes up. I mean, these are things that people really cherish.
No, no question about it. As a matter of fact, it is that I'm going to go back to that the bit of acknowledgement, and I think that's really where it is, because the note in and of itself acknowledged, and the way the mind works, let's just touch on it for a moment. You've got something called a somatic marker, and what it's like, it's an emotional bookmark, it's a tag. And what it does, if you see something now, it brings you back to the memory of whatever it was or something very close and familiar with it. So automatically when somebody sees something, that there's that millisecond of recognition that causes whatever that thing called love is for the moment, and that soft feeling, and then that's what they attach to what it is that they've seen. And you're right. I think everybody's at some time or another has had a note, and they've kept that note. And the reason they've kept that note is because it was personal. You just couldn't go in and buy it for somebody else.
Yep, that's absolutely right. It's a very personal thing, and it does. It becomes kind of like you said, it's that personal marker. It's something that they want to hang on to and keep those feelings and memories that are associated with it. You know, you mentioned love, Mike, Michael. I sometimes am reluctant to use the word love when I'm talking about these notes, but that's really what it's all about. You know, I've told people that my own personal feeling is that, you know, the heart has an infinite capacity to love. All you have to do is let it out. And sure, doing it through notes of appreciation is one of the best and easiest ways to do it.
By the way, when somebody says they don't feel love, love is, it's not so. It's an innate experience within all of us. Who knows if we can define it, but it is inside everybody. And what happens when you run into something like you're talking about, the letter of acknowledgement, you meet somebody that all of a sudden you want to be with, what it does, it unwraps all of those things that protect you from it, because maybe you got hurt by it at one time or another. So you've got it inside. All you have to do is find those trigger mechanisms to release it.
Yep, that's absolutely right. And as I said, when I talk to people and they tell me that they don't know how to get started or what to say, you know, I tell them, well, just put yourself in the other person's shoes. What would you want to hear? What do you want to hear from somebody else? And that makes it easier for people, I think. The other thing I tell people when they sometimes get stuck, I mean, because really we're talking about sharing your feelings, sharing your emotions when we're talking about writing a note of appreciation. And you know, that's tough for some people because, unfortunately, we don't do it often enough. So one solution is just to do it more often, and it becomes easier. But the other thing I tell people is, you know, this note of appreciation does not have to be a 3 or 4 page letter. It can be just a few sentences, a short paragraph, to just let somebody know, you know, that you're thinking of them, that you appreciate who they are, and that will just mean so much to them. And it affects you too. It just causes people, once you start doing that, then you start looking for things to appreciate about everybody.
Sure. And by the way, it's that old something that we've seen thousands of times, and it really comes into play. It's called life isn't measured by the breaths that we take, but by the moments that take our breath away.
Yeah, very nice. Yep.
It could be that strong. Now, by the way, is there a website we can find you at? So if we want to go to the workshops, buy the book, etc.
Absolutely. The website is noteproject.com, and I'm just inviting everybody to stop by there. Pledge to send a note. There's no cost to participate. And if you pledge to send a note, your pledge will count towards our goal of 1 million notes, which we think will make the world a million times better.
And by the way, I'll give you a quote by Eleanor Roosevelt, which is my absolute favorite quote. And it seems as though this would be apropos for what we're talking about. And she said, Eleanor Roosevelt, she says, yesterday's history, tomorrow's a mystery, and today's a gift. And that's why we call it the present. And with that, Michael Berry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Far away places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oasis. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Since serving in the bomber command of the Royal Air Force in World War II, our guest Graham Collier has been practicing. He's been a practicing artist and a teacher in Britain and the U.S. for more than five decades now. He's the author of several books, including the acclaimed Form, Space, and Vision, What the Hell Are the Neurons Up To?, An Antarctic Odyssey. He is currently a professor emeritus at the Philosophy of Arts at the University of Georgia and an associate fellow of Davenport College, Yale University. And let us say, are you here?
Yes, Graham, yes, I'm here.
Oh, hi, Graham. How are you? Glad we got you. By the way, Graham, thank you so much for joining us.
Not at all.
Good. Now, when I look at what are the neurons up to, what the hell are the neurons up to, what does that mean? What does that mean to the average person? How does that affect us?
Well, I think the sheer knowledge that you've got 100 billion nerve cells in the brain and trillions of interconnections from nerve cell to nerve cell to give you the consciousness that that you possess. And a neuroscientist will tell you that all you need is 50,000 such neurons in order to have a very good information system through the five senses. So you begin to wonder, well, why the hell do we have 100 billion and trillions of interconnections? And I suppose that ultimately makes you think that, all right, how am I going to explain Mozart and Einstein and Shakespeare and not to mention Florence Nightingale and Jack the Ripper? I mean, you've got such a range.
By the way, Graham, I think the reason this is so critically important to us with all of these neurons, and we're talking about the brain being an electrochemical factory and moving these neurons to the appropriate part of the body to get the reactions that we're looking for. But the key is it all has to do, it's wrapped up with each of these create emotions, good, bad, or indifferent, based on what we see, what we're presented with, is how we're going to respond and how we're going to react. But you can't get that same kind of emotion out of a computer.
No, that's absolutely true. I mean, the computer is a depersonalization of the individual experience of the world and the way that each person individually reacts to it and sees it. And what's more, tries to find meaning in it. I mean, what meaning and value is there to an individual human life? Each one of us has to face that issue. And the problem really is that whilst we live in the world of time, linear time, and with all of the evidence of the environment and our own particular environment, nevertheless, we also live in the imagination. So we live with the facts of life, so to speak, and at the same time, we live with an imaginative response as to why this, why that, and what are we to do with this and that, and is there any total significance to my life? And it's the individual private feelings and thoughts that you have independently of the senses. The senses certainly give you the facts, and the intellect will analyze those facts. But then the intuition and the range of feelings that accompany those facts can drive you into a totally sort of freewheeling world of the mind.
When we talk about a freewheeling world of the mind is broken up basically in two parts. You have conscious mind, you have your subconscious mind. Your conscious mind is responsible for all of your all the activity in the waking state. It's reason, logic, willpower, decision making. And between those two, there is a filtering system. It's like an analytical sense of evaluation. It's the one that protects you from that involuntary process. And that second part of the mind that subconscious mind takes things on once it gets into that mind as a goal to achieve. It can't distinguish between fact or fantasy. It deals in a language of pictures and symbols, etc. When you get too much into that conscious mind, that inhibitory process breaks down and things just pour into that unconscious mind and you start to react. Good, bad, or indifferent, you're going to have some kind of a reaction, the old fight or flight mechanism, the primitive urges that we have.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, what's got to be achieved is a balance. What Carl Jung called the theory of individuation is the ability to bring those two realities that you live with together to form your own particular view of the world. A psychotic personality or a neurotic personality is fundamentally incapable of bringing, shall we say, the facts of life and the imaginative mental wanderings as to its purpose and meaning and significance together, so that their personalities are split and they aren't whole. So wholeness, from a psychological point of view, is the ability to live with both these realities and know who you are as an individual, distinct from every one of the other 6.2 billion individuals on the planet.
Now, by the way, when we're dealing with that, and I think it's very important to look at unconscious mind and conscious mind, because it's that unconscious mind that's going to trigger all of the neurons, the hormones, and everything else that you're talking about to cause us to have that duality of personality. Mm-hmm. And I really believe that what you're saying underneath all of this is absolutely so. You get into the iPads and the cell phones and the whatever, now all of a sudden you're missing the human contact that triggers all of these things. And you're not
dealing. Right. Yeah. No. Well, you know, my favorite American writer, the scientist, Loren Eisley, he was the rector of the University of Pennsylvania for quite a time. He died in 1980. And he said that the real problem today is that humanness is lost to techniques.
Yeah.
Which means that, and the neuroscientists that I've been dealing with, especially one who's head of neuroscience at the University of California in Los Angeles, a man called Richard Thompson, was talking some time ago about the fact that it would seem that the right hemisphere of the brain is gradually losing its authority, which means that the right hemisphere is dealing with all of these subjective personal experiences and evaluations and feelings as to how this relates to that and who am I in all of this experience. Whereas the left hemisphere is the analytical, the logical, the sense-oriented half of the brain, which is now in dominance by virtue of the logical aspect of modern analytical technology.
So that, by the way, when you talk about losing authority, would you lose authority based on non-use?
It would seem to be that the left hemisphere is dominant because it is being used much more than the imaginative right hemisphere. And therefore, the right hemisphere would suffer some degree of atrophy by virtue of this dominance of the left, which is going on in the universities, it's going on in the schools. It's the things that constitute education today are facts. Find me the facts. Access the facts on the computer. But don't think about them. Don't sort of compare one and contrast one with another and come to a personal conclusion as to which of these various facts constitutes the greater truth. That process of self-involvement at the level of intuition, which is a right brain function, is suffering at the expense of the technical need to access information, just information.
No, by the way, you can see that in the personalities of the young ones today, the 18, 25-year-olds.
Oh, yeah.
You can hear it, you can feel it, you can experience it. Who was it? Carl Jung, who said that what we do is we assume, and an assumption can have an incontestable conclusion, so we take it on as fact. So we're running through life with assumptions, and those assumptions create our reality, and that may not have anything to do with reality.
Well, you have to sort of distinguish which reality you're talking about. The reality of the factual experience in time and space of our life, or the reality, the imaginative reality, that can lose all sense of time and space. I mean, you can be mowing your lawn and at the same time be miles away in your mind thinking about something important, something that struck you as being a paradox or a meaningful goal, or why you want to do this as opposed to doing that. So that they're not sort of totally authoritative in and of themselves. They should be working together. But, you know, the best example of that really is the dream. When you dream, you're out of linear time as we know it. You're into all kinds of other temporal possibilities. And the things that are happening are not logical in the sense that they relate to anything you know in the normal waking state. And consequently, you exist in the dream independently. When you wake up, sometimes the dream is more real and vital than the actual things you're doing, like shaving in the mirror or having your breakfast. You can't forget it. And Jung's theory...
Isn't that staying away from being mindful, being in the moment? You know, you've heard so many people talk...
Exactly. Exactly. That's why you get, you know, the old idea of the absent-minded professor, or... Yeah. Or the fact that Mozart, when asked how he wrote music, said he didn't write music. He would wander from room to room in Vienna, and in so doing, he would suddenly hear the whole of the 39th Symphony. And then he says in one of his letters, when I feel like it, I go to the rag bag of memory and write it down. So when he writes it down, it takes 45 minutes to play it with the instrumentation. But he hears it all simultaneously, not as a linear experience. So, I mean, how do you account for this kind of ability to move out of the world and time and literally create a thing like a great symphony, or create a poem? I mean, you know, there's that marvelous poem of William Wordsworth's that really says it all. It starts off, I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er hill and vale, when all at once I saw a host of golden daffodils beside the lake, along the shore, etc., etc. 10,000 saw I at a glance, tossing their heads in sprightly dance. And then comes the last verse. But often on my couch I lie, in vacant or in pensive mood. They flash upon that inward eye which is the bliss of solitude. And then my heart with pleasure fills and dances with the daffodils. That's a perfect example of an external experience creating an internal event.
Yeah,
and
no
without
question
that reflective aspect, you know, after the fact of sort of living with it after the fact as something that produces a feeling or a sensation or an awareness of a truth that's independently of the daffodils themselves. They've simply been symbolic in the sense that they turn you into yourself.
You know, it brings up an interesting point also. If we look at the trend that's going on today, that linear trend that you're talking about, that fact-based, this is what it is, trend, that also kills spirituality. I'm listening to what you're saying.
I wasn't going to mention that, but because it's such a... Nowadays, you get that people look at you and sort of walk away if you mention that there is such a thing as a spiritual element. And I think it's very important to separate spirituality from organized, institutionalized religion. I don't think they're necessarily the same thing at all. You don't have to go to church to have a spiritual experience. It would simply mean that the spiritual experience is one that suggests that behind the scenes there is some moral or creative force by which the brain functions. This is really the miracle, that the brain, being a great mechanical, in fact, organ. In fact, some neuroscientists say the brain is the greatest thing the universe has ever made. That brain can, in fact, be involved with truths or experience not available to the five senses. So how does an abstract experience come through a physiological organ?
Now, by the way, That, I think, is where too many people fall down because they can't define the undefinable. I must have been 18, 19, 20 years old. I'm laying on the beach in California, and I'm looking up at the stars, and there's a million stars out that night, and it was just gorgeous. And the more I looked, the more I looked, Graham, I got frightened because I started to think, what's beyond that?
Uh-huh.
And how could there be anything beyond the beyond, right?
This is right. I mean, it's exactly the same more at the micro level. When Francis Collins, who was the scientist who discovered the human genome, worked on it for 10 years, and finally, about 3 years ago, discovered what exactly is a single gene. How many combinations of DNA, RNA, and protein is there to compose one gene out of the 7 million you possibly have? And he came to the conclusion that there are 3.1 billion possibilities of DNA, RNA, and protein interaction in order to create one gene. Now, then you've got 7 million genes. I mean, the numbers alone are sufficiently mysterious, I think.
Let me hold on, because this is an important point. I don't want to lose this. That when you talk about that, you also just describe the beginning of the universe. Because, what else was it with the millions and billions of possibility and then the big bang and the explosion and then it reformed itself into whatever it is today? That's really what we're talking about here also, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, human evolution, in a sense, is a micro replica. I mean, the 500 million years for the brain to develop in the form it is now, and it's only some 2 to 4 million years ago that the corpus callosum, the bridge connecting left and right hemispheres, that gives us this duality of consciousness, according to most neuroscientists, literally became formed. So we're relatively new. I mean, 2 to 4 million years. Neanderthal man's about anything from 100,000 to 50,000 years ago. We're relatively new in this whole universal system and scheme. But what Francis Collins went on to write after he'd cracked this human genome problem with these simply astronomical numbers of DNA, RNA, and protein interconnections, he wrote a book called The Language of God. And his whole point was that such a fine-tuning in terms of such numbers cannot possibly occur by chance. That doesn't necessarily mean design, but it can't occur by chance. It has to have some kind of controlling factor that can fine-tune to that degree. You take one zero off one of those 3.1 billion possibilities, and you're gone. You're not the same person anymore. So that the element, really, that this book of mine is trying to discuss is mystery. Mystery of the cosmos, the mystery of us, and why we should have a duality. How can you have, for example, in London in 1843, Florence Nightingale and Jack the Ripper, who were born relatively close together within the same neighborhood. Therefore, you talk about nature or nurture. They were both, it would seem, although Jack the Ripper was never discovered, never caught, but he committed the most horrible disemboweling of ladies of the night in London. Florence Nightingale was the first nurse who brought medical services to the battlefield in the Crimean War, right to the front line, instead of 10 miles behind the line. So here you've got a highly moral personality, one of compassion and empathy with humankind in general, wanting to save lives, and the other one who is just destroying lives willfully. How on earth can you account? Is it nature in the sense that genetically you're born that way? Or is it spirit that is not there? Is the soul or spirit so weak that it has no effect? Or is it simply that their background produced these two different personalities? But they, it's very difficult. If you're talking about good and evil, the only way I think you can talk about it is, again, keeping out the sort of specifically Christian or religious factors that things that are good actually benefit and aid the general well-being of mankind. Things that are bad do not. Therefore, suicide bombers are evil or bad because they don't aid in mankind at all. I mean, they kill us. Whereas those people who save lives and heal would be considered good people. But the range of personalities that we meet, we all know this. You can meet people and you know that there's an incredible range of possibilities for what kind of a
Graham, I have to hold you up. We are running out of time. I could talk to you all night. Do you have a website we can find you and find the book?
No. Yeah, we don't at this point. They haven't got a website. Yes, it's on Amazon.com. That's right.
Okay. We can find the book on Amazon, and the book is What the Hell Are the Neurons Up To?
What the Hell Are the Neurons Up To? And it simply tries to explain us. Who are we? Why?
And Graham Collier, thank you so much for joining us.
Not at all. Very kind, Mr. Dresser. Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Yes. Bye-bye.
We long to be like Bangkok, Hong Kong, and Paris, and Venice, Tokyo, and Cairo, and Lisbon, and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Sienna, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Thought on Dresser After Dark. Mark Rozanovich is with us. He's the author of Zero Day. He's a leading expert on cybersecurity and a technical fellow at Microsoft's highest technical title. He's a contributing editor to TechNet Magazine and a senior contributing editor to or at Windows IT Pro Magazine, co-founder of Winternals Software, which Microsoft purchased in 1996. And let us say, Mark, hi, welcome to the show. Well, we tried. Okay, Mark,
Hello.
Are you there? Oh,
I'm
good.
Here.
Can you? Oh, wonderful. Mark, thank you so much for being with us. Zero Day, the title in and of itself says something. We are looking at cybersecurity and the word security. Is there even such a thing today?
Well, there's definitely such a thing as cybersecurity, but there's no perfect cybersecurity. As cybersecurity, there's no silver bullet, I guess, even with any kind of security. It's a matter of risk management and taking the right precautions to mitigate the typical kinds of risks that you anticipate.
You know, it's an interesting thing. We were brought up to say war and terrorism is somebody blowing something up, somebody physically doing something. But we really don't look at cyber terrorism as a reality yet, do we?
No, we don't. Actually, it's more than just cyber terrorism. It's cyber warfare in general. One of the things that you saw, for example, last summer was the Stuxnet virus, which a lot of people believe was a cyber attack initiated by a nation state against the Iranian nuclear program. And cyber terrorism is another form of cyber warfare. It's just initiated by, obviously, terrorists, which make it even more insidious because it's not some nation state that's dependent on the cyber infrastructure like the the more developed nations are. And so it's very difficult to counterattack or to even figure out where the attack came from. It's an ideal weapon for terrorists.
Now, by the way, Mark, one of the things that I'm looking at here, you know, you're a technical fellow at Microsoft, which is the highest technical position. So no one better than you could answer this next question. As you're talking and thinking about this, technology moves so rapidly. It goes so fast. And what we think is the best today may be outdated in 3 hours from now. How do you stay up with it? And I think that's really where the problem is, because about the time we would figure out the counter to whatever cyber terrorism is, somebody's got something different. This has got to be a 24/7 project, shouldn't it?
Yeah, you know, it absolutely is. It's incredibly tough to keep up with what's going on in the world of technology today. People have gotten a lot more specialized over the last 10 to 20 years just because the space has grown so large and so deep in so many areas. Security is just a great example of an area that's become very large, with a lot of different niches and a lot of different kinds of technologies that require some understanding of security, from browsers and the kind of information that your websites present to you, to programs and the vulnerabilities they might have. Each one is an area where people can spend a tremendous amount of energy and effort specializing in not just how the attackers go about trying to find holes and poke their way in, but also in developing countermeasures for those kinds of holes.
Now, by the way, Mark, the title of the book, especially the title, the subtitle in and of itself, is scary. 0 day, are we prepared for a cyber 9/11? And really, the answer to that, and I'm not technically oriented, the answer to that has got to be no.
Yeah, I think that the question itself implies that the answer is probably no, and I think that today it is no. It's just a risk that this country, for example, has just not taken seriously enough. The Obama administration is taking steps in this direction, but I think there's so many parties, as you know, involved in determining government's response and government's investment of resources that the progress has been slow. Howard Schmidt, the Obama cybersecurity advisor, he actually wrote the foreword for the book and obviously believes that it's something we should take very seriously. He's been working hard. I just talked with him last week in the Obama administration on taking steps to make sure that the government is getting more prepared for this kind of problem, not just, again, from cyber terrorism like the book portrays, but also cyber warfare, cyber attacks by nation states. But one of the problems that we face is the infrastructure that's owned by the private sector, and trying to get those companies that run the systems that this country depends on to also take security more seriously. We've seen so many breaches of security. If you just take a look over the last month, from attack on the London Stock Exchange to the RSA security breach to the Komodo SSL security breaches to the Epsilon security breach that lost millions of web email addresses. I mean, you see that it doesn't take much effort for the bad guys to get in today.
No, Mark, I thought for years and years now that, you know, we are the most powerful force in the world. Toe-to-toe, you don't stand up to this country. If you want us, the way you get us is internally. And this is a way of getting to us internally. But the damage that this could do, when I say in the right hands who knew what they were doing, would be far worse than a battle.
Yeah, I totally agree. And that's the impetus for the book actually came probably 6 or 7 years ago, when I started to see those waves of attacks across the internet that you might have heard of, Code Red and NIMDA and SQL Slammer, these attacks that were propagated by just kids and basically in their parents' basements, just seeing what kind of mischief they could conduct. And I thought, you know, somebody with some serious skills and knowledge with an agenda to go after, what if they resources behind it and actually went and tried to carry out some destructive kind of attack using these same kinds of technologies? How effective could that be? And you played it out, and it turns out to be a very scary scenario.
Oh, absolutely. And realistically, how do you even protect a computer today? Even the laptop at home or the PC or whatever it is that you're using, there are things that are constantly moving through. You just open it up to the wrong thing, you can get something and say, hi, it's mom here, and the next thing you know, the entire computer's destroyed.
Yeah, well, like I said, there's no silver bullet when it comes to security, but you can take steps that are considered best practice that will minimize the risk. Again, it's about risk management. And some of those things include what would happen if something went wrong? What would happen if somebody attacked your computer and got a hold of it or destroyed the data on it? Would you be able to go back and get to a working state? Would you be able to retrieve that data that was potentially destroyed? And that to address that, you, of course, have to back up your computer. And a lot of people don't back up their computer, but that's something that, just think about it. What would happen if my computer just completely died and I couldn't get access to anything that was on it today? What would I do? And try to see if you can get prepared for something like that happening, which is, you know, not just something that could happen from an attack, but just the computer failing just in general. Other things that are considered best practice are keeping your antivirus up to date, making sure your firewall settings are enforced, making sure that you've got your antivirus up to date as well, your program's patched, for example.
Now, by the way, the book in and of itself, it's a novel. Where do I see myself in it? As the average person, I sit down, have breakfast in the morning. Where do I see myself? How am I affected by what I am reading in the book? Or can be affected?
Yeah, it's exactly that kind of attack I just referenced when I was talking about making sure you've got your data backed up. Because the malware in the book, the terrorists, are basically going after simply destroying data. I mean, if you look at the attack of 9/11, it was about destruction. It wasn't about taking control of things. It was about affecting the morale of the West, affecting the economic foundation of the West. And if you carry that forward into what terrorists might want to do with malware, it's simply about how many Western computers, computers of the nations that we've got an issue with, how much data can we destroy on them? Can we take down their computers? Can we take down the infrastructure they depend on? And so from a personal perspective, it's about making sure that you're prepared for something like that. And it's also about helping to lobby, if you can, our government to make sure that they're taking steps to make sure that their country's defended against that, something like that, prepared to address it.
Okay, and we really don't think how devastating this could be. And I think the greatest example that I could imagine to say to anybody, and this has happened to me, and let me lay a base first. I'm going to take you back to 1983. In those years, I smoked. But in 1983, KFAR Radio, Fairbanks, Alaska, what we had to work with was a wooden desk, an ashtray, and a telephone. So that was it. You didn't think about what you have today. There was no such thing as what we have today. I remember leaving the house the other night, and I got about 5 or 6 miles out, and I went into panic because I forgot my cell phone. We are so riveted to those things, the computers, the cell phones, the iPods, the Blackberries, the whatever, that if somebody attacks that, they personally attack us today. We are so locked into it, it's almost like a human being.
Yep, just like you said, on a personal level, I mean, the dependence you've got on your phone, your computer at home, and then the indirect dependence that you've got on everything that those things and everything else that you do depend on related to computers. From where you go to the doctor's office and all your information's in a computer. You go to your lawyer, all your information's in a computer. If that stuff's lost, if it's destroyed, if it's out, I mean, people have encountered this too. You know, when computer systems are down at the airport, for example, they can't process your reservations. That's a huge inconvenience, and we saw that just with Alaskan Airlines a week ago Friday, where their systems were down for several hours, causing delays and flight cancellations that propagated in the next day. I mean, we're so dependent on computer systems that some attack on them could just, even a minor kind of attack, could have a devastating effect.
Mark, to do what you do, you have to be a visionary. What would you project a few years ahead? How do you see things changing? Obviously, what we think we have now is very sophisticated. It's not going to be in 5-6 years from now. Where do you see it going? Do you have any idea?
Well, I see, I have to harp on the theme that there's no silver bullet when it comes to security, but there are definitely huge amounts of improvement that we can have when it comes to computer security. Part of it is really designing systems with the assumption that they're going to be attacked and they're going to be penetrated. And that means isolating pieces, you know, but creating bulkheads, just like you would have in a ship, bulkheads separating different compartments so that if one is punctured, that it doesn't take down the ship because that leak from the outside is contained. And we need to do the same things with the computing systems that we depend on. We need to, of course, have backup systems, but one of the things is for our infrastructure systems. If somebody infects the the water supply systems in L.A., that attack doesn't propagate outside of that area that was breached. And speaking of the water supply in L.A., just last week, an independent security researcher at a security company was hired by the city of Los Angeles to do a penetration test, and that's what's called when they hire people to come and see if they can find vulnerabilities in the system. They were able to compromise the water system of L.A. in the simulation that they performed, which, if in the hands of a bad guy, would have been able to pollute the water and cause lots of sickness in the L.A. area. Just another example, but making sure that those kinds of attacks, if they are successful, are contained.
And that's really the key, is to be able to contain them. Now, what department, what governmental department is responsible for that? And the reason I ask that is, there really a governmental department responsible for that? Are we that far advanced in our security that there is a designated team to watch for this and know exactly what to do and take action if something happens?
Well, the team that comes closest is the Department of Homeland Security. The other groups within the government, the FBI, CIA, they're more charged with protecting the government's infrastructure and not so much the private sector's infrastructure. And the problem is that when it comes to computing systems, the government's operations are really indirectly dependent on the private sector's infrastructure, the critical systems infrastructure, so to speak. So it's really the Department of Homeland Security which has been charged with protecting the nation's borders and with some of the nation's infrastructure that is responsible. There's a cyber command that's been set up that's associated with the NSA, but that's, again, more affiliated with protecting the interests owned by the government and not so much the private sector. So right now, some of the private computing infrastructure this country depends on is really falling through the cracks when it comes to the government, at least, helping to define standards for protection and auditing, for example.
So interesting enough, Mark, when what I'm hearing you say, and stop me if I'm wrong, we don't have anybody. You know, you've got Homeland Security, but they're not looking out for the average citizen. They're looking out basically for the government, which is all well and good. There's somebody that has to. But there really is no protection for you and I, is there?
Not directly, no. And that's a big problem. Like I said, Howard Schmidt, a friend of mine, Obama's cybersecurity advisor, he's working, and like I said, I talked to him last week, and he's making some progress. A lot more progress to be made, though, but we've got a big hole right now.
But what do you do about that? When I say what do you do about that, so you know about it, I know about it, now other people are going to know about it. What do you do about something like that? How do you create the protection that you need? And there is protection that you need. If the water system was affected, if the food was affected, I mean, any number of things. We can go on, you know, for days with what could happen. That could kill a lot of people.
Well, I think that what we've got to do about it is make sure that our representatives in the government are aware that we do believe that this is a problem, and we do believe that this is something that the government should consider a priority and put investment behind right now.
I'm almost smiling over here. The thought that just struck my mind was, yeah, in their spare time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I wish I had the, you know, send an email to this address and everything will be fine and dandy, but unfortunately there's no simple solution like that.
See, but the point of contention is that you're out there, and the more exposure that you get, because you're saying it and you're doing it in such a way that, you know, it's not emergency, take a look at it now, and oh, here we go again, conspiracy theory. That's not what we're at here. You're looking at it logically. You're saying this is what it is, and you're saying it in a way that people will listen, and I think that in and of itself is critical.
Yep, I am portraying kind of a worst-case scenario, although that worst-case is a very achievable scenario. That's the really kind of scary thing about it. If somebody put their minds to it, they'd achieve something very much like it's in the book. Another person that's been trying to raise awareness, like I have, is Richard Clark, who's been associated with government cybersecurity and national security since the Reagan era. He wrote a book last year called Cyber Warfare, which was another kind of his attempt to ring the alarm bells and shake government out of their complacency in this area, which he's been working on for probably two decades. But that was his latest stab at it. So there's other people that are also trying to raise awareness and cause some change here.
No, which is good. Now, by the way, do you have a website we can find you at?
Yeah, I do. The book's website is www.zerodaythebook.com.
And what about yourself if we want more information? Are there seminars, workshops, things you do?
I do, and actually there's a Mark's Events tab on that website, so if somebody wants to see where I'll be doing book signings or lectures about cybersecurity, that's the place to check it out and keep up with what I'm doing.
Wonderful. Mark Rozanovich, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Michael. It's been a pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
Thanks. Good night.
In love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. We are moving rapidly tonight. Our next guest should be up fairly quickly. Dr. Michael Applebaum, MD, is going to be with us. He is the only medical doctor to hold certifications in 7 different fitness specialties, spanning youths through seniors. He's recently been interviewed on Fox News, Your World with Neil Cavuto, and he's created the Fit to Parent program, and he's the author of The Fitness Med, Guide to Healthy Eating, Why Diets Fail, The Simple Mistake That Ruins Millions of Lives, Be Your Own Personal Trainer, Mathematics, and How to Get Rich Not by Dieting, and also the official I Hate to Exercise diet book. And let us say, Michael Applebaum, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. Hello to you and your listeners.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when it really comes down to it, we're talking about a country now that obesity is running rampant. I know you walk into any market and you see people massive size. Michael, what do you think causes that? I mean, it's not as bad as it was 10, 15 years ago.
Well, it's worse than it was 10, 15 years ago, how big people are. And what causes it is one thing and one thing only, consuming more calories than you burn. There's no other way to gain weight except to do that.
Okay, but the consumption of calories, okay, that, you know, people don't exercise, Michael. And by the way, you've been on with me before. We've been together a couple times here. I've been a bodybuilder for the last 100 years. I don't know what it's like not to work out, but to get someone to move, to burn calories, to do something for themselves, seems almost impossible.
Well, there are a couple things about that. The first is exercise is a fool's approach to weight control, or it's an approach for the leisure class because it's terribly inefficient. Second of all, in order to be a quote-unquote bodybuilder, which means to add muscle to your body, you must overconsume calories, because just as it is impossible to not gain weight when you consume more calories than you burn, it is also impossible to add muscle to your body without adding weight. So you have to overconsume calories. You can't be on a diet to lose weight and gain muscle at the same time. The problem with the weight control issue is that the linchpin to the entire system for it to work is caloric intake control. Exercise recommendations, besides the fact that exercise is a terribly inefficient way to lose weight, and exercise is a fool's game for weight loss because it's substantially more efficient and easier to do it with caloric intake control, the exercise recommendations that are promulgated by the government are impossible to follow. And although it would take time to go through it, and if you wish, I'd be happy to do that, the fact remains that the recommendations that we're asking people to follow require near Olympian efforts as the bottom line, and people aren't Olympians, only a very select few.
By the way, Michael, we've gotten lazier and lazier as the years have gone on. We are so used to hitting a button, a microwavable, fast-paced world, that people really don't use their bodies as much as we did before.
But the simple thing to do then is that if you use your body less, then just consume fewer calories. You know, it's the distinction, for example, if your income drops, you have a choice. You can either spend less or you can get another job. So when it comes to caloric intake control, that is the easier way to go when your activity level decreases.
Okay, but when we really look at it, the average person, isn't that habit, repetition of action, isn't that something that we have to get a mindset about more than anything else? Because if I think it, then I'll move towards it. But if I don't have that mindset, I have watched people time and again, Michael, they go on some kind of a diet, and next thing you know, they're, you know, 24 hours a day, they're stuffing themselves, you know, with food and can't understand why they're overweight.
Well, part of that problem is the fact that diet recommendations are all screwed up. And the reason diet recommendations are all screwed up is because they're based on the same flawed assumption. And it makes no difference whether it's the, and this is my humble opinion, the people who are conning the population, like Oprah and her experts, or whether it's the medical establishment, everybody basically uses the same approach to weight loss. And an industry that has a failure rate that's reported to be at 95%, and if it's not 95%, it's clearly astronomical, that continues to exist is an aberration. Any other product, any other industry with that kind of a failure rate would have collapsed by now. The fact of the matter is that diet recommendations suggest, and these are by the powers that be, that people consume the same number of calories or fewer than the Nazis fed people in Dachau. And the fact of the matter is most people who undertake diets do it voluntarily. There's no gun at their head. And a voluntary undertaking that puts people in a concentration camp is not going to last long enough for them to succeed. The data are clear. When people go off from starvation diets, they overconsume calories. Whether it's because they're so relieved or whatever, it makes no difference. But starvation dieting is not going to work. Quick weight loss has a very, very special name, and that name is failure. So you have to not listen to the experts if you want to give yourself a chance in order to lose weight successfully.
Michael, I think I've loved Jan Brewer ever since she, from Arizona, the governor of Arizona, ever since she took her stand on the border and illegal aliens and so on and so forth. But she just recently may have stepped a little bit too far as regards to charging people for being overweight.
Clearly she's doing the proper thing. Unfortunately, it is too feeble an attempt. The problem with it is that not enough money is being assessed against these individuals, that adults with kids are not being hit hard enough. It still medicalizes weight loss, which is going to be fatal to any successful outcome. And unfortunately, and April happens to be Child Abuse Prevention Month, and nutritional child abuse, fattening kids up for the kill, is the number one form of child abuse of which we are aware. It unfortunately ignores its own state child abuse and neglect laws. However, that said, it is a step in the right direction, because what she is requesting is that people who pose an increased risk to an insurance system pay an increased premium because of that increased risk. We see that and we don't howl about it when, let's say, 17-year-olds are charged more for driver's insurance as opposed to a 45-year-old. And this also is the way things work in some of the private sector, where people who are at higher risk pay more because that is the nature of insurance. So she is simply doing nothing more than what is standard every place else.
Okay, so what she's saying, there's consequence for your weight. And if you're not going to take care of it yourself, maybe the value for losing weight and keeping your money is greater than the value for paying money and keeping that weight. So what she's saying
that your extra weight puts you at a greater risk of a payout, and therefore you are going to have to pay more into the system because you are at a higher risk. Whether that changes people's behavior or not is a different issue. And if it does change their behavior and they lose the weight and they become a lesser risk to the insurance pool, then they will no longer be paying the extra amount, which is more premium, essentially.
Now, by the way, you can see the battle that's going to go on with this, and the civil rights and the rest of it, and whatever. Which
there
I think
are
is
no
a
civil
show.
Rights to this. That's a distraction. That's a bunch of garbage. That's a bunch of people howling for no good reason.
I'm on your side.
It's
the challenges that she's going to face by moving through this, and we stand on the same side of the table. You got me. Okay, I'm there.
Got it. And what people are doing is they're putting up these false arguments. It's a distraction.
Yeah. No, I completely agree with that. But if she's going to do it, it's got to be done all the way. And I think you're spot on saying, you know, a $50 annual fee is to apply to all children, adult. Oh, those are smokers. All right, so she's going after the smokers and the obesity. So that's $25 a month for insurance if they don't attempt to lose weight. That's not a lot of money.
It's a $50. It's a $50 fee. That's the difference in the premium.
Okay, that's not really enough to make anybody do anything.
$4 a month.
Yeah, Michael, that's not enough to make. You said it early on when we began. That's not enough to make anybody do anything. You've got to make it stiff enough, and you've got to stretch for it.
So it doesn't even come close. So even though it is an attempt, and I've characterized this as feeble, and I think it's got other flaws, it ain't going to work because it just doesn't do enough. It doesn't go far enough. This is the kind of thing that people shrug off.
Yeah. By the way, which I think is interesting also, some of the talking points with this fat tax, obviously, but the other thing is fat people should be discouraged from having kids and pay more if they do, which is
Absolutely.
Kind of an interesting way to look at it.
Absolutely. And there are very good reasons for it. The first is that fat people cost more when they have kids. Hospital costs for prenatal care are dramatically higher for overweight and obese women. Costs for these individuals are fivefold to 16 full times greater than for intended size human beings. There are huge numbers of complications that are associated with being obese or overweight and having kids. And the fact of the matter is that the latecomers to the party, even though I've been suggesting this for years, the latecomers to the party who now advocate for this include the European Society of Human Reproduction and Embryology, the American Dietetic Association, the American Society of Nutrition, Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, and Massachusetts General Hospital, part of the Harvard. Those last two are part of the Harvard Medical System. So this is becoming mainstream because it should be mainstream because these mothers pose risks, increased risks, not only to themselves, but also to their unborn fetuses, right? The unborn is a fetus and an embryo,
sure.
And also to their infants, and their kids who are at risk to grow up to be overweight and obese just like their parents. In fact, when you have overweight parents, it's an almost 100% certainty you're going to grow up to be a fat kid. That is nutritional child abuse. That is a problem. And
by the way, no question,
more.
I think two things here. One is, which would stop me from being obese because I'd be too embarrassed to register get on the registry of fat people. I mean, there's no question I would not want to sign up for it. And the other thing, businesses should avoid hiring fat people. That one would be a major problem.
Well, it wouldn't be a major problem because you always have a choice who you pick and you don't have to say what it is that you're doing.
So Michael, in today's world, you don't have a choice of who you pick. This is the one we'll disagree with.
Say I'm not going to hire you. But the fact of the matter is that even if you do find yourself in a situation where you are forced to hire somebody like that, the fact of the matter is, and these are the federal government's own statements being paraphrased by me. In fact, let's just lay a foundation. The raison d'etre for a workplace wellness program is in order to increase productivity among the employees and to decrease sick care costs. And if you look at how workplace wellness programs are suggested, they are basically glorified diet programs, which is why they're never going to work. The fact is that the reason that they're pushing workplace wellness programs, besides the fact that the government is unwilling to assume its own responsibility, which really means saying making people responsible for their own behavior, but the reason that they do it is, and the carrot that they hold out before employers, is that fat employees are there less, they have a higher rate of absenteeism, they, when they are there, are less productive, which is called presenteeism, and they cost more for insurance. So even though you may have the quote-unquote same job or same job description, the fact is you are not doing it as well as somebody who is intended size. So there are reasons to pay these people less. There are reasons not to hire these individuals because it's a poor business decision, and these reasons are supported by the federal government.
Now, by the way, the key here is this. People have choice. If you want the job, if you want the whatever the case may be, lose the weight. So there is choice in that.
Well, my suspicion is, and I'm not providing legal advice, even though I'm an attorney, but my suspicion is that if you tell somebody, you know, if you want this job, lose weight, that becomes a problem. My suspicion is that if you say, you know what, we're not going to hire you, we're going to continue our search and just shut up, then you probably are in a better position. That's my guess.
Okay, but, you know, with the fat tax that you talked about, you know, the zoo-level scales, the ton-tested toilets, the Nimitz-class wheelchairs, the rest of it, and the Bunyan-esque caskets, putting tax on those, I think, would be a very interesting thing. There would be quite a battle with that one.
Well, look at what people are suggesting. They're suggesting that we should tax foods because of the calorically irresponsible. What that means is that those of us who are calorically responsible and don't get big and fat and overweight and become greater burdens to the system are being penalized. But it's like a cigarette tax or an alcohol tax. Essentially, only those people who pay those taxes are the users of those products. So what they should be doing is they should be placing taxes on those products, those instrumentalities that are used by fat people. There would be huge gurneys in hospitals. There would be cherry pickers in ambulances in order to lift these individuals. There would be scales that weigh 400, 500, 600 pounds. There would be toilets that have to be put into the wall because they have to support a ton of weight. These are the things that should be taxed. The rest of us shouldn't be penalized for this.
That's a good point. No, it is a good point. And I think the key is, I'm going to go back to that word choice again. You can choose not to carry all of that weight. It may be held
against you. That is a choice. Overweight is a choice. Yeah. Obesity is a choice. There is nothing but choice involved in all this. There is no genetics. There is no virus. There is no bacterium. There is no ethnicity. There is no environment. There is no culture. The only way that somebody gets fatter than they ought to be, the only way that they become overweight or obese, is by consuming more calories than they burn, period, end.
Isn't that when it really comes down to it, if you think about that? And I've been around, I've never been overweight, but I've been around a lot of people who have, and I've said it time and time and time and time again over the years, that you eat, you bring in so many calories, and if you don't burn that amount of calories off, you're not going to stay level, you're not going to stay even. You burn off more than you eat, you lose weight. You keep more than you burn off, you gain weight. It's the same thing that you're saying, and it's a very simple fact, and people need to get that.
It's more than a fact. It's a law of thermodynamics. To suggest that it's otherwise is to suggest that there's an option to gravity. It just doesn't exist. There is nothing else in this game. It's calories.
And I hear you loud and clear with this. Okay, this particular message of yours, how strong is it spreading? What kind of resistance are you getting?
Well, it's not. Look, when I have the opportunity to speak with people, they understand the crux of all this one is bad diet advice. You know, you can give people the opportunity. It doesn't mean that they'll seize it. But our responsibility ought to be to give people good information, good advice, and a pathway to succeed at this. They will not find this, in my opinion, from the sick care establishment, from the government, or from the media. Each one of those entities has a vested interest in keeping people sick. The government does it because, hey, otherwise what am I going to use the discretionary spending that I have at my disposal but to promise you health? Healthcare has nothing to do with anything that the government can do. Healthcare is what an individual does in the privacy of his or her own home, period. That's it.
Yeah,
the rest of us do sec care. I'm part of a repair and rescue industry. That is what the medical profession is. Big media needs to sell advertising. There's a lot of advertising that goes together with the diet and weight loss scams and exercise scams. And quite frankly, the sick care establishment has good reason to keep people sick because that way you've got repeat customers. If anybody's interested, they should really read George Bernard Shaw's The Doctor's Dilemma. It's sort of an interesting piece and gives you an understanding of what might be some mindsets. But the data upon which even the good and willing and trying to help physicians base their diet programs on are corrupted data. And that needs to be understood. And that leads to all sorts of expensive problems like bariatric surgery. Because if people were provided a mechanism in order to lose weight that actually had a chance of working, then bariatric surgery would not be as necessary, quote-unquote necessary. The problem with it is that nobody's informed that the diet that they're put on is a starvation diet like the people suffered in Dachau. They are going to fail with certainty, and they really weren't able to provide, in my opinion, an informed consent to their bariatric surgery, which, in my opinion, creates an atmosphere of malpractice.
Now, by the way, Michael, when you come to with the bariatric surgery, that doesn't mean that it's a guarantee that the weight's going to completely stay off. There's a tremendous amount of people who have had those surgeries, and the weight's come back.
The data are clear. Lap band surgery in particular is terrible, absolutely terrible. And the dollars and cents involved are huge. So, for example, for a kid to have a bariatric surgery, it runs around $31K. If that money were simply put into a simple interest-bearing account of 5% by somebody who started at the age of 18, by the time they led a normal life span, they would have over $10 million in the bank. This is huge stuff. For a 12-year-old, it's going to be closer to $18.25 million.
Yeah, no question about it.
The money that's wasted is huge, huge. It's insane.
I have a friend of mine in Chicago. By the way, you ever run into Mayor Eisenstein?
Mayor's also a medical doctor. The American College of Home Obstetrics. Worked with Robert Mendelson. Mendelson was an extremely interesting physician who happened to be one of my advisors when I was going to my medical training.
By the way, have you seen Mayor lately?
I have not.
118 pounds he's lost.
Good for him.
Yeah. No. He got it loud and clear. And this is... Yeah.
Of course, the underlying caveat is hopefully he did it intentionally.
Oh, he did. No, he's not sick. I know him very well, and this was intentional. And his wife also lost 50, 60, 70 pounds, and they decided it's enough is enough, and they did it together.
Good
and he's
for
looking
him.
Great.
Good for Mayor. Congratulations.
Yeah.
So the bottom line to all this is that the sick care profession, we basically, because of the way that we recommend that people lose weight, we basically are the executioners, because the problem arises that people fail at starvation dieting, they go back to eating, they eat more than they had before, their body mass index increases, the higher your body mass index goes, the greater your likelihood of developing these certain illnesses that are bad. You try dieting again, but all you know how to do is starve. You go through the same process again, you get bigger and fatter. That is the reason behind yo-yo dieting. And the bigger and fatter a person gets, the more likely they are they're going to suffer the consequences of these certain bad illnesses. And the bottom line to all that is that we, as a profession, in my humble opinion, should not be in the business of executing our patients.
I hear you loud and clear. We're starting to run out of time. Website we can find you at?
People can find out information about me at fitnessmed.com. or drapplebaum.com. Those are the best places.
Hey, Michael Applebaum, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Again, best to you and your listeners.
Take care. Good night.
You too. Take care. Bye-bye.
Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places. Mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is. So why stay there? And there are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. So many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Radio Susie, where are those numbers? Telephone numbers. Can't call me unless I know what number to call at. Somewhere there's a number. Yes, we love the number. Don't go away. We'll find the number. And welcome back again. I'm Michael Ray Dresser. Steve and I are with us, Managing Director of CIMA and AIF, with Strata Wealth Management and Hightower Advisors, LLC, the largest registered investment advisor in the country. He wrote, choosing simplicity because he learned the financial decisions are not the only choices that affect our finances. And let us say, Stephen, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And thank you so much for being, you know, there are so many people today who do not understand money. How are you able to sit down with a person and really move through what's available, knowing that they're on the same page you are?
Well, there certainly are a massive amount of options out there. Everyone's situation is different. I think it's a matter of sitting down with that person, with that client, and getting to know what's important to them.
Okay, and that's kind of interesting, isn't it? It's working backwards. What's important and how do we get there?
Absolutely, yeah. And that's the same strategy that I believe is what the book is emphasizing. It's taking that exact same tact, looking at the big picture of what's important and then determining your choices from there.
Now, and that's the key. You know, the word choices, if I could use that word 1,000 times a day, every day of the week, 8 days a week, how's that? I think most of us have choices and we don't know. It's not what we don't know, it's what we don't know we don't know. And that's why somebody like yourself, a financial advisor who's practicing, who's doing this every day, they can look over our shoulders and say, these are the other set of eyes that see what we don't see and then move us in the right direction.
Yeah, I think that's well said. What we don't know certainly will have an impact on us. And naivety is not an excuse.
No, not anymore. Not with especially with the way the world is going today. And when you're dealing with your own personal financial matters, you know, we've had, you know, as you've said, you know, the Ponzi schemes, the rest of it, the meltdowns and. And I don't even know if it's poor judgment that people deal with the banks and the mortgage companies. I think a lot of that was intentional, but that's another story in another show. They're frightened to death to put a dollar out there anymore because they don't know where it's going to go. How do you create that confidence again?
I don't think it's a matter of creating the confidence. I think people want honesty. I think people want to... You know, they don't want a story to build them up and get confident if it's not true.
Sure.
And the reality is that people just want the truth. People want to know what the risks are that are out there and what the likelihood of encountering those risks are and need to understand part of what we do at Strata Wealth Management Hightower is really educate the client about what's happening. You know, why is the market rallying? What is the government response? What is the Fed doing? And really bring that education and understanding to that individual so that they can at least comprehend what is taking place. And from there you build.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest problems, Stephen, that we have today, add a couple of things to the mix, ideology and politics that have to do with the direction of your money. And there's a tremendous amount of masks that are worn by the people who do control the money. And the biggest problem that we run into, by the way, I've got to figure out how to get rid of that. I have something called IncrediMail, which my email comes through, and for some reason it wants to jump into the sound here. So if you hear strange noises, I promise it's not us.
But
politically, and I don't want to get political with this because that's not where we're at with this particular subject, but you've got to take in the general sense of the word, you've got to take into consideration what effect the direction of your money is going based on the culture at the time, the ideology at the time, the political impact of the desires of those people moving for their own agenda. So you got to get all these things involved and somehow filter through it to get somebody comfortable because it's very scary today.
That's certainly true. The market has been dictated more by macro themes over the last several years opposed to micro themes. and political processes and what the Fed is doing and what the policy is going to be going forward has a tremendous. It probably has more of an effect now than it's probably ever had, just simply because of the route that the government and the Federal Reserve has taken. So I couldn't agree with you more. Macro issues are incredibly important, and although they're not investment related, they certainly have a tremendous bearing on it.
No, absolutely, and it's the average person doesn't understand it, and it doesn't mean that they don't have the capacity to understand. The average person doesn't understand because it's not their language, and for the most part, it's not their way of life. I have to keep my finger on the pulse of what's going on politically, monetarily, socially, culturally, the rest of it, based on what I do. I'm, a 24/7 guy with this stuff, and but sure. That doesn't mean that other people do that. And right. Most people, if you ask them a question about finances, they're not going to know.
And that's true, but that comes back to personal choice, though.
Sure.
Because most people are more interested in what Lindsay Lohan or Britney Spears is doing, opposed to real content in politics or in policy in the Federal Reserve. So it's our own fault, really.
Oh, I agree. It's our responsibility, yes.
Right. Yep.
Because in the end result, we let them do it. And we let them do it because they promise us things. And if you're going to promise me something, I'm yours. And that's really the way that the culture has gone in the last 10, 15 years. And that in and of itself causes a lot of problems. And then when they get the reality of what's going on, now they don't like it.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. We're a reactive society, both as a populace and from the top.
Well, sure, and I think a lot to do with that, and not to stray too far, is that the conglomerate, the press corps, the culture, not even a corps anymore, it feeds on drama, it feeds on image, it feeds on emotions. You know, they need war, they need disaster to sell newspapers anymore because there's such competition. And there's where really the key is. What we're seeing is the worst of everything. They're not giving us the best that we could get because that in and of itself does not sell. And there's where I think a problem is, where a lot of people are not seeing what's really going on. The market, if you listen to, based on what news station you listen to, you're going to get an answer, a different answer every day of where it's going, up, down, backwards, or where.
And that's I couldn't agree with you more on that as well. That's why I believe it's also important to get your news from other sources. For example, I read the BBC every day, Al Jazeera, South China Morning Post, the Moscow Times, and all the traditional newspapers here, Financial Times, and a lot of blogs. And I'll tell you, when you do that, when you read all of these different publications, you get a much different perspective, they all have their biases, of course. So you have to filter that through what's being posted on Al Jazeera versus what's being posted on Fox News. But when you take all of that information in, you filter it within your own mind, you can become more objective. And I think that's very important because if you only focus on one genre of news or one station or one website or whatever it is, you're going to have a bias and unable to see what's going on.
Yeah, maps, no question about it. And if you want to know about us, you take a look at the people who would back us up, and at the same time, you look at their ideology and what they think about money. You go to China right now, China owns us. I mean, there's no question about that. I really think if you dig down and find out who's holding your mortgage, you're going to find some Chinese banker.
Well, sadly, that's true.
Before you can solve a problem, you've got to identify what the issue truly is. And before you can identify the issue, You've got to first understand what the position of that issue, where it's viewed from. And if you talk about China, it's the same thing. How did they look at it? And when you're dealing with them, you're dealing at two different positions, economic and the other one is ideology. Tie the two together, and then you've got a third. You've got a third entity, especially in China and those countries, the military. And the military right. and the government are usually two separate entities.
Hmm. Yeah, there's so much to the China story, and there's so much to the global economy and to where we're at right now, whether it's the Federal Reserve policies or every, you know, there's so much to it. It's such a complex situation.
Well, sure. And no question about it. When you really take a look at it, China in and of itself, you know, what we bought so much from them, we give them so much cash, they funded their own military with our money. And you know, when there's a problem, we can't say anything. But what we do is we've gotten into a position where we have no GDP. I mean, it's there, but it really doesn't mean anything. We can't afford to produce anything ourselves because we can't be competitive globally, and that has an effect on the kind of investments we make.
It certainly does. I mean, China has, 800, 900 billion. The estimates are do vary, but they hold a tremendous amount of our paper, and that's just in treasuries. Like you said, they hold a lot of mortgage paper. And in some ways, you know, they're raising interest rates right now to fight off inflation. In some ways, they are acting more democratic and more free in their markets than we are, which is...
By the way, you've hit on a very interesting point. And if you think about what's going on right now, look at all the upheaval in the Middle East right now. They're all saying we want freedom, we want to be a democracy. They're all fighting to be who we are. What's the battle here? We're trying to fight to be like they are. And it's a very interesting catch-22 that we're in.
It is. And just touching on the Middle East, sure, it's if you give democracy to the Middle East, I mean, like the Palestinians did, they elect Hamas, which is a terrorist group, you know.
Yeah.
So just because there's democracy there does not mean that
you
we're
got
going
it.
To have, you know, some regime in there that we're going to be happy with. We could be exactly the opposite. We could be in much worse shape after all of this occurs over the next whatever number of months it's going to be. We could be in worse shape with the regimes afterwards. It's there's a lot of uncertainty right now.
And all that has to do with an ROI, a return of investment.
Hmm. Yeah.
It all has an effect, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
Yeah, and that's why I like your book, Stephen. It's The Choosing Simplicity. You don't have to go through all this muck and mire to be able to get decent investments and get some kind of a decent return on your money. We also deal with a cyclical economy. No matter which way you look at it, go back over the last 100 years, and what you're going to find is it's cyclical. It has its booms, it has its busts. It goes up and it goes down. But the one thing that's constant, Stephen, it always recaptures.
That's true. It certainly always has.
And okay, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Certainly. It's choosingsimplicity.us. And
that's simple.
Okay.
I like it.
Yeah.
All right, great. Can we get the book there?
You absolutely can. You can also find it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or any of the other online book retailers.
Great. And then we also, we can contact you directly for consultation?
Absolutely. Yes.
Wonderful. Okay, Stephen, we're about out of time. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Okay, take care. Good night.
And faithful and true, and cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you, and I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You're listening to Dresser After Dark. If there's a subject that you'd like to hear addressed on the show, someone you'd like to hear interviewed, contact Radio Suzy. You'll find it right on the homepage of the website. And you can find all of our guests on the guest page of the website, www.dresserafterdark.com. Thanks for listening. And if you're listening on the web, tell your local radio stations about the show, too. That's the way we grow. That's the way we do something called network. I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
Lovers, whatever you do, say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
And I keep being told to say this. Don't forget, you can call in. This is a live show. You can call 530-413-4511 or 530-413-4515. Tell your friends about it. You can get answers right now for the problems that you face today. We'll be here for you.
Once upon a time,